we'll move on to your suppression, but there is actually something that we did need to reflect further on in chambers, but we can do that at the end of the day. Right.
Thank you, Your Honour. So I'd like to proceed first with the legal submissions that were filed on the 15th of June in relation to the expiry of deemed permits and the rights of priority. And prior to commencing with the submissions, I do want to make an oral submission in relation to the relevance of the Section 124 issue with respect to Plan Change 7. And the submission I wish to make in that regard is one of the submission that the court need not make a finding in relation to Section 124. It's not necessary to make that finding in order to address the issues that are live with respect to Plan Change 7. And that submission relates to all of the options that are currently before the court in terms of what might happen to Plan Change 7. Now, in terms of the issues that have been addressed by Dr. Somerville and responded to in the written submissions, there were three questions that were asked. We are in agreement with Dr. Somerville in relation to questions 1 and 3. The point of departure relates to question 2. So what I propose to do is to address the court with respect to question 2 only, and if the court's content to take the submissions on the other two questions as read, mm-hmm. I'll be content with that.
Yes.
So in relation to the second question, what I propose to do is to take the court through the summary in relation to the submissions that are set out at paragraph 3 of the written submissions. And as noted, the Council does take a different view in relation to Section 124 and considers that a deemed permit, including the right of priority, can continue to be exercised in accordance with Section 124 of the Act until a decision is made either granting or refusing consent. And I set out the reasons for that submission, the first of which is that mining privileges are deemed to be a water permit or discharge permit under Section 4131. Under Section 4131 and subsection 2, such permits are deemed to include, as conditions of the permit, such are the provisions of the Water and Soil Conservation Amendment Act of 71 as applied to the mining privilege. A right of priority is provided for under Section 11 of that Act. Therefore, a mining privilege with a right of priority is deemed to be a water permit or discharge permit, including a right of priority as a condition. Section 41.
So you're saying under Section 11, so I'm just slowly getting into the database as well, so I might go to hard copy.
Actually set it out in 11. My paragraph 25, but yeah, Section 11.
Yep. So you're saying Section 11 creates a... Yeah, what are you saying about Section 11?
A water permit,
yeah,
with a right of priority as a condition of that permit.
And I wanted to look at that. So there you're saying the relevant section is 11, not 13, for the purpose of your argument. Correct?
Yes.
Yeah. just about there. Now, I'm just wondering if that's right, because section 11, the title to section 11 is retention of right of priority. Then it goes on to say, every holder of a current mining privilege who holds a right that was conferred by the Mining Act or any former Mining Act was in force at the commencement of this part of the Act, entitling him to exercise the privilege with priority over any other user, shall retain that right. So it's talking about the retention of rights, not the creation of permits.
That needs to then be read in the context of section 4131 and 2 of the RMA.
So the holder of privilege is subject to a right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then the deemed permit resulting shall be deemed to include as conditions of the permit. And it says such of the provisions of sections 4 to 11. 13, 14, 16, as applied to the privilege.
Mm. So as I understand this provision, and you may have a different view, that firstly, the first question is there a current mining privilege or a right that is granted? Yes, there is. Is that privilege, in this case a mining privilege, I'm subject to a right? Yes, it is. And so both the mining privilege becomes the deemed permit and the right becomes the deemed condition. So Section 11 of the Water and Soil Conservation Act is not creating a privilege per se, nor a water permit per se. Yeah.
Yes, it's Section 413 that's having
that does
effect.
That. Yeah.
Yes. Back to paragraph 3, subsection C. Section 4131 provides that the provisions of the Act other than sections 128 to 133 shall apply to a deemed permit. My submission is that Parliament has explicitly excluded provisions of the RMA from applying to deemed permits, and relevantly, it has not excluded the application of section 124. Therefore, I submit that section 124 applies to a deemed permit, except as otherwise provided in section 4132 to 10. There is nothing in section 413, subparagraph 2 to 10, to suggest that section 124 should not apply. Section 4133 provides that every deemed permit is deemed to have a condition to the effect that it finally expires on 1 October 2021. Section 1243 applies when a resource consent is due to expire and allows a holder to continue to operate under the consent, which includes the conditions of the consent. Section 4137 provides that a deemed permit holder may apply at any time under Part 6 for another permit in respect of the activity to which the deemed permit relates. Section 124 is located in Part 6 of the RMA. The continued exercise of a deemed permit under Section 124, while an application is being determined, is consistent with the legislative purpose of Section 4133 to ensure that mining privileges are phased out completely by 1 October 2021. The operation of Section 124 ensures that deemed permits are phased out, but that permit holders are not disadvantaged if the Council does not determine their application before the 1st of October 2021. And finally, Section 124 itself explicitly excludes specific resource consent applications from relying on Section 124. This does not include deemed permits. If Parliament had intended that Section 124 was not to apply to deemed permits, I submit it would have said so explicitly.
Is that the reference to the coastal permit?
Yes.
165.
Yep. ZH.
ZH.
Now, that's a summary of the key points of the submissions on the second question. I do wish to address you briefly in response to the submissions that have been filed in response by Dr. Somerville. The first point that I'd like to respond to is paragraph 8 of Dr. Somerville's submissions. And in that paragraph, he makes the submission that Section 124 is a procedural tool to manage the transition between expired deemed permits and applications for replacements. Now, as I read Dr. Somerville's opinion, he seems to be suggesting that Section 124 applies during the period of time between when the application to replace the permit is lodged and the 1st of October 2021.
Sorry, just pause there a second. I was just making a note of the paragraph that you were responding to. So as you read that, you think the submission is addressing the period
between the lodgement of an application and the 1st of October 2021.
Just let me read that with that in mind.
Now, my submission is that Section 124 would have no effect during that period of time because the holder of the permit being replaced can simply rely on that permit up until the 1st of October 2021. So Section 124 has no relevance or no application or no effect during that period of time. I want to touch briefly on the use of the phrase finally expire, and Dr. Somerville places some weight on the use of the word finally in contrast to the description of other permits such as the coastal permits referred to in section 168.
I'm just sorry, before we move on, is that what he's actually talking about, though, paragraph 8? So you've got, thus section 124 is a procedural tool to manage the transition between the expired deemed permits, so it's from the 1st of October, and the applications for replacement. So it's not from filing your application 6 months ago to the 1st of October, it's actually from the 1st of October.
Well,
decision, hopefully.
If that was what the opinion was saying, then yes, I would agree with that.
You would agree with that, okay. But
But it seems to be that Dr. Somerville is saying that in the context of these deemed permits, Section 124 has no relevance after the 1st of October. read in isolation.
He's saying that 124 applies to the taking use of water, but it doesn't apply to the priority. And if that's what he's saying, then you would have, you still would disagree with him, but.
Yes, and just in terms of the location of that paragraph and the two preceding paragraphs, and his conclusion that section 124 can apply in the intervening period up until the expiry, the issue I take with that is it has no application. In terms of reading paragraph 8 in isolation, I would agree it is a procedural tool to manage that transition between the expired permit application permits and I would go further, it's not just applications, it's determination of applications for replacements.
Next point.
Some weight is placed on the phrase finally expire.
Yep. Paragraph
9. In contrast to the coastal permits referred to in section 165ZH, now the submission I make is that there's no difference between something finally expiring and expiring. There's no moment in relation to, well, the addition of the word finally doesn't add anything to something expiring. Now, my friend Ms. Williams will address you further on the relevance of the phrase finally expire in the context of the deemed permits, insofar as that phrase is used with respect to the compensation provisions. Paragraph 11, Dr. Somerville refers to a deemed water permit being a creature of statute. He concludes that paragraph by noting that it has a statutory expiry date after which it no longer exists in law. And that raises the question of whether a water permit or any other permit issued under the RMA for that matter is any different in the context of those permits and authorities also being a creature of statute, are simply a creature of a different statute in this context.
So what's your point? You've already agreed that deemed permits are a creature of statute, and you're saying that there is no... Yeah, so what is your point?
There's no distinction to be drawn
between a deemed permit and a resource consent.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And how do you get there?
Resource consents are also creatures of statute in that the Resource Management Act sets in place a regime to apply for a permit. The permit is issued under that legislation and thus is itself a creature of statute.
How he's using the phrase, though, a creature of statute. I mean, isn't he using that in relation to the deeming provision? The deeming provision deems mining privileges to be something that they're not, which is a resource consent, in this case, a particular resource consent, a water permit. Whereas resource consents that are the result of an application under the RMA are resource consents, and so you're qualitatively looking at quite different things, and that's how he's using creature of statute.
Yes, if that's the case, my submission is that nothing rests on that distinction, given that the language used with respect to permits issued under the Resource Management Act also uses language such as expiry of permits, and section 124 operates in response to the expiry of a permit.
Mm-hmm.
paragraph 13, Dr. Somerville submits that there is no longer an existing consent under which the holder may operate after the date of expiry. In my submission, there's no difference between the situation that exists with respect to all other water permits or permits under the RMA that are, I'll use the word, protected by section 124. Those permits too have expired by that time. And the phrase existing consent in that context is referring to the consent that was the subject of the application to replace it, which engages section 124, and that is engaged at a time when the permit is still a current permit. Two more points to address. The next one is at paragraph 29, where Dr. Somerville notes that there is an interpretive presumption that Parliament intends to legislate in a way that produces a practical, workable and sensible result. Now, in my submission, a reading of the relevant provisions in a way that results in section 124 applying in the context of deemed permits does produce a practicable, workable and sensible result. I make that submission because on the basis that there will not be a gap between when applicants have lodged applications to replace their permits and the council finally determining, or the council determining and any subsequent appeals being finally determined with respect to those applications. In the absence of that occurring, consent applicants would need to somehow predict how long the council might take and any appeals might need to be resolved and thus lodge their applications sufficiently early to avoid there being a gap after the expiry date. And the final point relates to paragraph 30, and this was a point in response to the ORUG interpretation, and the submission is read, literally the legal consequence of ORUG's interpretation would mean that deemed permits might never expire, which would make it very difficult to address applications for resource consent by non-deemed permit holders. Now, I'm sure my friend will address you further on that, but in my submission, section 124 does not operate in such a way that protects in perpetuity applications that have been lodged prior to expiry, because there is still an overriding duty in the Resource Management Act to avoid unreasonable delay, and that would require the processing of applications.
So, with that in mind, what is the duty that applies to the processing of these applications? And I say that if some applicants, or all applicants, it depends on where the court's decision goes, need to amend their applications to take advantage of the control RDA rule. And so we've already, the proposition is, obviously the court's got to make a decision, then there will be time needed to do exactly that, and then time needed for processing. Is it possible for an applicant to simply place their application on hold, so that's the first proposition, or B, not progress it in a timely fashion such that the benefits or intended outcome for the region is not secured? In other words, consent holders just simply continue to take water under their existing permits, expanding their area of irrigation, increasing irrigation efficiencies, and not adhering to historical use.
Yes.
And so that's your risk.
Yes. Now the.
So how do you address that?
So
how?
The submission and response, and it perhaps starts with the question of, can an applicant for consent lodge an application and then the next day write to the council saying, can I please put my application on hold, which used to happen a lot. The legislation has subsequently changed in relation to the period of time within which applications must be processed, and the Act is now far more prescriptive about the timeframes within which both applications need to be processed and also requests of further information need to be responded to, because that was another point at which the process was delayed. So.
That being the case, I understand that there are hundreds of applications which have been put on hold. How long can that... is there a statutory time limit determining how long an application can be put on hold? And it may well suit all parties in the room that that's the case, but beyond that, is there a statutory time limit that fixes how long an application can remain on hold?
I'd have to go back and track through the specific provisions within the Act. My recollection is that the provisions have been tightened up with specific periods of time specified. Of course, there is the ability to extend timeframes under 37 capital A, I think it is, but that only enables, a doubling of that period of time without taking into account a range of other factors, such as effects on third parties.
So I would actually like advice on that, because that seems to me to be at issue here, is how long applications, remain on hold post-court's determination.
Yes.
And then the impact on the attainment of the objective.
Yes. Is that something that we could address in our reply, or do you want to have a response to that?
No, the reply is fine.
Okay, we'll certainly track through the provisions. And I think the second part of that is that the broad duty to avoid unreasonable delay, but I'll pick up that in the context of those other provisions which have more clearly defined time limits. So those are the submissions I wish to make in relation to the priority question. Do you wish me to address you now on the VIRES?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I have actually prepared some written submissions on this issue, and I'll hand those out. Now, I should note that these submissions were prepared in response to the provisions that the...
I've got a lot of paperwork, but I'm actually doing the distribution.
Right.
So I was thinking, I'm glad you didn't oral that. All right, good.
Right, so these were prepared in response to the provisions that the planners had put forward. Now, the world has moved on a little with the provisions circulated today, but there will still be some provision, matters I can distill from these submissions that will equally apply to the provisions that have been put forward. So I'll just need to work through carefully to make sure that those points come through. So in terms of the submissions lodged, or in terms of what Council was directed to respond to, firstly, the viros of the amendments proposed by the planners that seek to replicate the effects of the existing rights of priority. And secondly, to comment on whether a condition restricting a third party would be valid if the third party gives their approval prior to the condition being imposed on the consent. Now, it may well have been that what Your Honour had in mind was this issue of the written approvals that was discussed yesterday with the witnesses, but things appear to have moved on from that point.
Still think you need... You may still need that. I've just put up something which I think would work through, but as I said, I didn't look at the definitions, didn't look at what a condition could look like. It may be that that overcomes the written approvals. Maybe not.
Yes.
Yeah. Sure. I thought it was a bit more streamlined than what was being proposed, but... I don't know. It's all I could do at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Yes. So in terms of the written submissions, paragraph 6, I addressed the entry condition into the controlled activity rule, and that I noted had been replicated in the restricted discretionary activity, so same rule, and I think in terms of where things are perhaps heading, if a solution is to be found, it will apply both to the controlled and the RDA by way of entry condition. And in my submission, the entry condition component is important. It would be insufficient simply to have a tick box on the application form, because the bringing down of the priority is a fundamental element of the controlled activity rule, and thus to qualify for consideration under that rule, an entry condition needs to be crafted. And in terms of whether that rule is a or would be a relevant rule to include in a regional plan, I've addressed the functions of the council and note that the functions include the control of the taking, use, damming and diversion of water. In my submission, a rule dealing with the use of water would fit squarely within those functions. So at paragraph 12, that the proposed amendments, as they then were considered to be consistent with the requirements under section 68. I'll perhaps expand on that submission once we hear back from the planners on the final set of provisions being recommended as part of our reply submissions. So I then turn perhaps to the more critical issue at hand of whether proposed conditions meet the requirement for valid resource consent conditions, and this is picking up on this third party approval point. So the vires of the amendments is directly affected by the ability of rules to establish valid and enforceable resource consent conditions. The provisions must lead to the establishment of a lawful resource consent condition or conditions in this regard. I've set out at paragraph 14 the requirements for valid resource consent conditions under section 108AA. I don't propose to take you through those. Paragraph 15, I make the submission that the condition is directly connected to a regional rule. So if the rule is valid and within the functions of the council, then a condition responding to that rule fits within squarely within section 108. AA. then the final point I make in this section is at paragraph 16, and that if the applicant chooses the controlled activity or the restricted discretionary activity pathway, they will be agreeing to the condition by virtue of proposing the condition in the application to meet the requirements of the entry condition. I then touch on some case law which addresses the requirements for consent conditions, and I've set out the relevant matters at paragraph 18. And at 19, I've set out the, perhaps the corollary in terms of conditions that have been found or held to be invalid, and the categories there is if they're so unreasonable that Parliament could not have, clearly could not have intended that it should be imposed. Second, it ultra vires the powers of the local authority. A third, involving a delegation of the local authority's duties, or are simply uncertain. A condition may also be considered unreasonable or unlawful if it is unenforceable. So relevant to that context is whether reliance on compliance by third parties or third party approvals arises in this context. So a condition that relies on compliance by third parties has in the past been considered unenforceable. However, this was in the context of a condition stating that reversing and turning right from a site was prohibited, as the consent holder in that context could not control the actions of those who came to visit the premises.
So just pause there a second, I want to read that.
The law on third-party approvals was recently summarised in the High Court decision in Lysart, a decision of Justice Fotter. This case noted the previous case law on the matter, suggesting that a condition on a resource consent which requires the agreement of a third party is ultra vires, or that a condition imposed on a new consent cannot negate the resource consent of a third party. The conditions in this context do not rely on compliance by third parties nor the approval of a third party. There is no additional approval or action outside the terms of the consent required, as the consents will have been granted on the basis that the conditions are imposed. The conditions will be placed on both the dominant and the subservient permits. I say that there is no requirement for the dominant permit holder to exercise the option of serving notice on the subservient permit holder to cease taking. However, if that action is taken, then the condition on the subservient permit requires the subservient permit holder to stop taking on receipt of that notice. The imposition of the condition on the dominant permit does not require an agreement of the subservient permit holder, or I submit vice versa. If an applicant does not propose to include a condition replicating the effect of the exercise of the right of priority expressed on the expiring permit being replaced, then the application will fall to be considered as a non-complying activity. In Lysart, the court also noted case law suggesting that there can be a distinction between conditions that require an applicant to bring about a result which is not within the applicant's power, that is to construct a new roundabout, and a condition that stipulates development should not proceed until an event has occurred, that is, after the roundabout is constructed. Now, in my submission, in this context, the requirement to cease taking upon receipt of a written notice is more akin to the latter situation, and that the event that has occurred is the receipt of the notice.
Just pause it a sec. And Justice Fotter had no difficulty with the second proposition.
Correct.
Okay. I take it that, not that you hardly ever find any cases which are directly on all fours, but is Lysart dealing with a similar or quite dissimilar factual and condition, including so the proposed conditions there?
Quite dissimilar, there is the case of Hampton and the Canterbury Regional Council from the Court of Appeal that I will come to, which appears to be more closely aligned. It's a case in the water context, so I'll get to that shortly. I'll touch next on the delegation of local authority duties or reserving discretion to a future date. submitted that the conditions proposed do not amount to an unlawful delegation of functions or a situation where the council is reserving a discretion to a future date. The relevant decision is being made at the time the consent is granted. The decision is to impose the condition on the subservient permit, and that will be made on the basis that the subservient permit holder has proposed the condition and therefore is agreeing to the grant of its consent in the knowledge that there may be times when they cannot take, and that is when they have received notice from the dominant permit holder, because the dominant permit holder is not able to abstract their maximum authorised rate of take. In terms of derogation from grant, the council does not consider that this creates any issues in terms of derogation, and that this is on the basis that the condition would be imposed on the subservient permit at the outset, so as that permit is granted on that condition. This is different to situations where conditions have been found to be unlawful in the past, where they have negated the resource consent of a third party, as the condition is part of the rights that are conferred on the subservient permit holder when the consent is granted. The imposition of the condition does not affect resource consents that are already in existence.
Just pause there a second, I just want to reread what you've said.
Further, this is not a situation where the council is reserving its discretion to a future date. The relevant decision is being made at the time of the consent being granted. That is, if the dominant permit holder cannot take its full allocation under its permit, then it can serve notice on the subservient permit holder to cease taking. Upon receipt of that notice, the subservient permit holder must cease taking. And I now address the example in Hampton and the Canterbury Regional Council. Now, whilst the situation, the factual situation was somewhat different, the Court of Appeal decision in that case did involve a scenario where a condition provided that a consent could not be utilised while another consent was being utilised. And I've set out condition 5 of that resource consent at paragraph 31. And in this case, the Court of Appeal did not appear to be troubled by the concept, although I should say that the decision ultimately was dealing with other conceptual issues. But it is an example of...
One other conceptual issues. I've read the case. What conceptual issues are you getting at?
Now, Hampton was dealing with the...
Right to transfer.
It was a transfer between the two brothers, Hampton, and whether the permit could have been transferred without notifying the other brother, from memory.
Just pause there a second. And with Hampton, and I know it's referred to by others, and I wasn't quite clear what its relevance was to this case, but with Hampton, there was an application, as I understand it, a first application to transfer part of a water permit that was expressly subject to a cousin or a brother being able to utilise the right. Application was granted subject to your condition 5. Transfer was made to the third party, and then Hampton wanted to transfer his brother's share, and that's what that case revolved around. And it was like, well, heck, you've actually... I thought the Court of Appeal said that's not the basis of your application, and you're going to be stuck with it. You know, you're stuck with the basis of the application. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And the reason for... the reason for highlighting it in this context was simply the condition within that case that referred to a party ceasing taking if another permit was being exercised.
So I understand why it's been referred to. Okay.
I note that the Court of Appeal in Hampton also referred to the decision in Araki, where the High Court held that a consent authority exercises its statutory functions of regulating or managing the allocation or use of a resource through its power to grant permits. That the High Court in Araki noted that the RMA effectively prescribed a licensing system. And the relevance in terms of that submission in this context is that these conditions that are seeking to recognise that others have, I'll call it a right of priority, over them is essentially an allocation mechanism under the Act. Now, in terms of where I go next in these submissions, I'm addressing the question or the issue of the condition is actually being volunteered by the applicant in choosing to go through the RDA or the controlled activity pathway. My submission is notwithstanding that the condition is being volunteered by the applicant, the condition could validly be imposed by the council without necessarily relying on essentially an OGA condition. But in any event, I say that because the condition is being volunteered by the applicant, it provides a further backstop in terms of the legality or the vires of the approach. And I'll step through that approach now. So in this case, the council submits that the proposed consent conditions meet all the requirements in order to be considered intra vires. However, for completeness, a condition that may otherwise be considered invalid may be able to be imposed if a consent applicant volunteers it. This is covered by both section 108A1A and is the principle established in OGA. I've set out the passage from Fraser's Papamoa, where the High Court noted that the OGA principle is a narrow one and not to be extended beyond its proper role. And I'll leave you to read that. Now, in my submission, these requirements would be met by an applicant proposing a condition in an application to meet the entry condition. Now, I should note when reading through the list in terms of paragraph 34 from Fraser's Papamoa, the application form itself does not use the language of an undertaking being given in terms of the condition. In my submission, the effect of volunteering a condition in this context would have that effect. But if there was a concern about that and the reliance was on the OGA principle, the application form could easily be amended to require that condition to be given on the basis of an undertaking.
The applicant's undertaking? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'd submit that the the grant of the consent would be issued in reliance on that undertaking. The imposition of the condition would be broadly encompassing that undertaking, and that there would be detriment to, in this context, other parties if the undertaking is not complied with. And so in conclusion, the Council submits that on the basis of this case law and the Council's statutory functions, the regulation of access to freshwater as between users is a legitimate resource management issue that can be controlled through regional plans, and that the proposed amendments to PC7 are lawful, and I would make that submission in the context of the direction of travel in the reframed or revised provisions circulated today, and lead to resource consent conditions that in my submission are valid. Those are my submissions.
Thank you. I suppose for my part, the what we've proposed is more clearly OGIA-like than perhaps what the planners are proposing, but hopefully more simple in terms of the mechanisms to perfect it, both in terms of the form and material to be accompanying an application for resource consent, but we'll see when they work it through. But anyway, the important point is that there's nothing that the court has proposed in principle that offends your submissions.
No.
Alrighty. Thank you.
Shauna, please.
No, good.
Thank you.
Who next? Ms. Williams.
I believe it's me, Your Honour.
Yeah.
I might start with the virus issue, Your Honour, and with respect, I adopt Mr. Moore's submissions.
Okay, well, that's easy.
And the only additional point that I would like to make, Your Honour, in terms of VIRAs is about the gap, if I put it that way. On VIRAs, Your Honour, is simply, to emphasise section 108AA1A, which in my submission puts into statutory form the OGA principle. And in fact, it doesn't refer to an undertaking, it simply refers to an agreement. So in my submission, on the basis of 108AA1A, actually an agreement is sufficient. It doesn't need to be specifically expressed as an undertaking.
All right. And, okay, so in principle also what the court has proposed
absolutely
flows with just more submissions which you adopt. And does it resolve the drafting issues which were discussed yesterday with planners?
In my submission, they would, Your Honour. And actually, again, I was reasonably comfortable that where the planners had landed was going to be intra-vires, and certainly the court's version takes that further, so I'm comfortable with that.
Vires aside, I think we had drafting issues in general, that was all.
Yes.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Then, Your Honour, turning to my submissions in reply, and actually, I'm sorry, Your Honour, I note that the front page doesn't say that they are dated the 15th of June, but they are dated the 15th of June. And, Your Honour, again, just in respect of question two, there are probably three points, Your Honour, which I would like to highlight in my submissions. And in my submissions, Your Honour, you'll see that my heading to my discussion of question two on page five is I've talked about a qualifying application to replace a deemed permit. And that, in my submission, Your Honour, is important because this is actually coming back to section 124.
Sorry, which paragraph are you at?
So I'm on page 5, and it's actually the header up to my section dealing with question 2.
I just don't have that on page 5. Hold on, maybe I haven't got your right submissions. No, I don't. Sorry.
That's all right, Your Honour.
Page 5.
Yes, page 5.
Okay, page 5 in the heading, question 2.
So question 2, where I say I disagree with Dr. Somerville, and I say I consider on a qualifying application to replace the deemed permit. So that's important, Your Honour, because the qualification actually refers to section 124, and the requirement under section 124 that an application is made at least 6 months beforehand, or otherwise at least 3 months beforehand, and then with council's agreement, in a sense, in essence, rather, to allow the permit to continue. So those are the two factors which make it a qualifying application. And the qualifying application is also tied to the expiry date. So it's tied to the expiry date of 1 October. So that's why there was this rush to get applications in before 1 April by 31 March or before tomorrow, the 30th of June, and before 1 July, because those are the two dates that make for a qualifying application and which would allow Section 124 to apply. I agree with my friend Mr. Moore that the gap which is being addressed is the gap between when the permit expires and when the application is processed and a replacement new permit is issued. So that's the gap that Section 124 addresses. And in a different statutory context, Your Honour, there was an amendment to the Conservation Act in 2012 to address a similar gap between the expiry of concessions when applications had been made for replacement concessions.
Which section?
That section is Section 17ZAA. And I think Section 17ZAB deals with a similar situation. But in essence, Your Honour, my point is that there is, and it's acknowledged that there can be a gap between a permit or a concession expiring and the processing of a new permit being, or application being completed for a new permit to be issued. And that gap is what Section 124 is intended to address. And in my submission, Your Honour, I agree again with Mr. Moore that Section 124 cannot apply until the current permit has expired, whether it be a deemed permit or a resource consent, however it is granted under the RMA. So that's my first point, Your Honour. My second point, Your Honour, actually is in relation to the nature of deemed permits and the conditions that are carried over, deemed to be carried over by Section 413. And so in my submission, Your Honour, Section 413(1) is very clear in combination with Section 366 that mining priorities, mining privileges rather, have stopped. They are ended as of when the RMA came into force on the 1st of October 1991. And what has happened is that we have a new permit, deemed permit, which is created by the operation of Section 413 as of the 1st of October 1991. So this is an RMA permit. It is not something else.
It's a deemed permit. It's not a resource consent which is granted under this Act.
Well, I'm actually going to take you, okay. And I think that's done by some of my colleagues as well, but the definition of resource consent refers to Section 87 of the Act. Section 87 of the Act then sets out the various types of resource consent that could be granted, and that includes a water permit under Section 14 of the Act, and a discharge permit under Section 15 of the Act. The effect of Section 413, paras 1C and D, are that it deems permits that are a water permit and a discharge permit under those relevant provisions of the Act. And so in my submission, Your Honour, they are captured within the definition of resource consent, which is what Section 124 refers to. Then, Your Honour, we have the application by Section 413, subsection 2 of the various provisions in the Water and Soil Conservation Amendment Act 1971. and there's the reference to sections 4 to 11, 13, 14, 16, etc. And, of course, the priority right entitlement is continued by the operation of section 11 and then the ability to exercise under section 13 and I think 14. But that's not the entire story, because we also have, and I've set out in summary at para 33 of my submissions, some of these other deemed conditions which are reflected from the Water and Soil Conservation Amendment Act 1971. So section 4 is the entitlement to construct and maintain water races and to divert and use the water in a water race. And then section 5 is the entitlement to excavate, construct and maintain and use a dam. Section 10 is the entitlement to occupy the land forming the course of the race or the site of the dam. So those matters are also, if we're going to say that rights of priority are deemed conditions, then equally these must be deemed conditions which are continued by the operation of section 413 subsection 2.
Just pause there a second. Whilst I dial up the section.
Yep. In my submission, Your Honour, it just cannot make sense for those conditions, which are also deemed conditions, to finally expire on the 1st of October 2021, where there has been a qualifying application made under Section 124. That would not lead to, in Dr. Somerville's words at para 29, a practicable, workable and sensible result. Your Honour, the other thrust of my submissions in relation to question 2 was actually looking more broadly at the purpose of sections 413 to 417. And in my submission, in effect, they're almost a mini-code. They're not a code because a code would exclude the application of the rest of the RMA, and they don't do that. But they certainly are a specific set of provisions dealing with what are described for the purposes of those sections deemed permits. And in my submission, Your Honour, and this is why, again, in my submissions, I referred back to the decision of Judge Smith and the Environment Court in 2002, the 28/2002 case, where the court summarised the both the provisions of the RMA and the Water and Soil Conservation Amendment Act 1971. And in essence, Your Honour, the 1971 Amendment Act tried to, in the context of the 1967 Water and Soil Conservation Amendment, Conservation Act, and also the Mining Act, which was a fresh legislation as of 1971. So it attempted to deal with mining privileges and bring them into line with the Water and Soil Conservation Act. And the way it did that, Your Honour, was by actually saying that there was no longer a perpetual right of renewal, which had been one of the key factors of mining privileges under the previous Mining Acts. However, what the 1971 amendment did do was it said that if an application to renew was declined by a consent authority, I'll call it that because I think at the time it might have been a catchment board, but whoever it was, that compensation had to be paid. And so the effect of requiring that compensation had to be paid if a replacement was not granted was that in effect they were continued even though the perpetuity right ceased as of the 71 amendment. By contrast, Your Honour, what the RMA did in 1991 was it actually provided for the 30-year transition phase-out period for deemed permits, but also provided that no compensation is payable, and that's in section 416. And in my submission, Your Honour, that's where the final expiry date is actually relating to. It's about the not only do you not have an automatic right of renewal, but you no longer have a right to compensation. And that is the key distinction between the RMA reform as opposed to the consolidation which might have occurred under the earlier statutes. Sorry, Your Honour, I just do have one more point on Vires, just to return to that briefly.
Okay.
And this is actually section 413, subsection 9.
This is on Vires?
This is on Vires. Mm-hmm. This is in relation to, I guess, imposition of priorities, Your Honour. So section 413, subsection 9, deals with the situation where for an existing deemed permit there's an application to transfer. And in particular, paragraph A is talking about, so that refers to section 136.2b1, which is where there is an application to transfer a point within a catchment, but which is authorised under a regional rule. And it actually says that despite that, you still have to treat it as if it was an application under section 1364. Then goes on to deal with some other matters, makes it clear that they no longer will be property rights. They are now subject to section 122. They're also now subject to the review provisions, which are otherwise excluded. And importantly, Your Honour, paragraph C says that in addition to the matters which are set out in section 1364B, in considering an application to transfer the whole or part of a deemed permit to another site, the Regional Council shall have regard to the effect such a transfer would have on the relative priority and entitlement to water in the catchment and may modify the priority or other conditions of the transferred deemed permit. Mm-hmm. And in my submission, Your Honour, that certainly puts in statutory form the thinking that dealing with priorities, which would have to be as between respective consents, is something that the Council has the authority and the power to do. And to carry that further, Your Honour, presumably the Council has the power to impose conditions.
So you say this in order to say, in order to support, in principle, the Council can make objectives, policies and rules pertaining to these priorities.
Yes.
Yeah. So yes. Sort of a general.
Yes. So I'm not saying anything specific, although maybe, Your Honour, that this addresses the question of how did a new resource consent end up with a priority condition? And it may be that it was actually through the application of this provision.
Oh, that's small burn.
Yes.
All right. No, that's fine.
Yes. And unless you have any questions for me, Your Honour, that is...
I do not.
That's fine.
Just whilst we're hanging about there, but it's more a question for Mr Moore. Subsection 6 of 413, that's dealing with enforcement procedures. And the applications by the Regional Council under 316, which is why I was thinking, this is High Court business.
The submission that I had made in the context of the High Court business was the ability to enforce directly as between consent holders.
Oh, okay, right. All right.
So that was...
That, yeah, if you want to do that, it's got to go somewhere else.
Yes.
Yeah, and the Court of Competent Jurisdiction being
the High Court.
Yeah, High Court. Actually, it's probably a question for both of you, because we'll call it at five. I'll talk to both of you about this. What about enforcement? You know, whether it's what the court suggested or what the planners have suggested, is that giving you any anxiety? Now, don't just say you shake your head, no anxiety, because you just got to get a solution and get the heck out of here. It's a serious question. Does it give you any anxiety? Okay. Firstly, OGA conditions. So it's what the court's proposing. It may be what the planners were proposing. OGA condition is directly enforceable, but just under the normal mechanisms, I would have thought 316.
Yes, 312 in my head.
Oh, well,
anyway,
you might be right. Yeah.
About there.
Yeah, so that's just enforceable in the ordinary way.
Yes.
And it'll be subject to proof, etc.
Yes.
Prosecutions? Well, no. Regional Council also. Can Regional Council enforce an OGA type condition?
My understanding is yes, it can.
Yeah.
Once it's a valid condition on a permit, it's a condition that then can be enforced.
Yeah.
Because the breach of the act authorised by the permit, you're not complying with the conditions of the permit, so you'd be in breach of the act. So the offence is breaching the act without complying with the permit.
Abatement notices?
Same again.
Enforceable by the council, but can it be action can't be taken, or can it be taken by a neighbour?
Not in the context of an abatement notice.
No.
The action that could directly be taken by a consent holder would be an application for an enforcement order, or alternatively, presumably, a private prosecution.
Yeah. And so prosecution, and again, I think that's the other thing giving me anxiety, and in some ways it's a silly thing to be anxious about, because no one's ever asked the council to enforce these things, and their effect, I suspect, isn't because they replicate the act, but because they promote good behaviour or a continuation of certain behaviour.
Yes, and like lots of, I'd say, new conditions or conditions touching on new subject matter, circumstances where they haven't been enforced before, there's always a level of anxiety as to how it might play out. But what one can do is work through those conditions and make those conditions as robust as possible. And that really is the exercise to be undertaken. I think it's fair to say that the compliance team did have some anxiety in terms of the conditions, and that will have come through fairly loudly. And clearly in the evidence. And that, I should say, was a helpful exercise, both for perhaps the court and also for the council. But in the end, we come back to the question of are the conditions and the types of condition being referred to here, do they fit within the framework of conditions that have previously been found to be valid in terms of sufficient level of certainty for a valid purpose, etc.? And the submission that I've made is that, yes, they do, and therefore they are capable of enforcement, albeit there may be, as there always are, some practical challenges associated with enforcement. But those challenges exist with respect to enforceability of not just these types of conditions. I'd submit that the same issues might arise in terms of dealing with minimum flows or residual flow type conditions.
So to the extent, I was just thinking about that case of Sutton and Canterbury Regional Council.
Oh, Sutton. Which one was that?
Oh, 2015 High Court decision. I think it's Justice Gendall. And about the council's duties in terms of getting its records right, getting its house in order. To the extent that Ms King and Mr Cummings are talking about issues about the council's house not being in order, well, you've got to put it in order.
Quite.
Yes, and I think you accepted the duty
yes,
on behalf of ECAN when on that decision. And so it seemed to me a lot of the anxiety was anxiety around its own records, but it's also anxiety as to this is probably one thing that does bother me, activities which have occurred, say the shifting of a point of take, which have not been regularised, as it should have been regularised under Section 413. And so what to do about that?
Yes, I was listening with some interest, and in my mind I was trying to work out whose problem is that. Is it the council's or the consent holder? The reality is it's both.
It's both. And so if you do come across that, and I know the answer, somebody seemed to say, oh, well, you know, if they've done it and it's been right, she'll be right for the last 10 years, she'll be right for the next five or six or however long. Is that, how would you approach that, where you have got, and again, I remember from my days as a practitioner in Canterbury, a lot of irregularities with the records, which was both, you know, clients were providing records again and hoping that, you know, were loaded correctly onto the database.
Yes, I would have thought as part of the consent replacement process, those issues will need to be resolved and or clarified. Mm. So if you've got a situation where a point of take has moved, say unlawfully, if they haven't followed the process under Section 136, it may well be that upon consideration of that application, the council will require a Section 136 application to deal with the point of take.
And it may require neighbours approval in that case to regularise.
Yes, particularly in circumstances if the point of take is moving or leapfrogging another permit. So that would need to be considered. So I anticipate that the applications will come in, the point of take will be specified, there'll be reference to the permit being replaced. If there's a mismatch at that point, it will become obvious and it will need to be regularised.
So I think what you're saying, despite the lack of transparency, if you like, at the present moment as to how permits have been are currently being exercised, that is not causing you any anxiety in terms of what has been proposed to overcome the priority gap.
No, because a mechanism exists to deal with that issue. So I'm comforted by the existence of Section 136 to allow the transfer of the point of take if that has in fact occurred.
Okay, all right.
And
saying all that, Ms. Kings and Mr. Cummings' evidence was in fact extraordinary. I would have thought extraordinarily helpful in terms of the exercise ahead.
Quite, it's focused some attention on what the future may look like.
Yeah, and the effort to get people in to regularise what those activities are. Yep. Okay, so Ms. Williams, you've been nodding away, and so no particular anxiety around enforcement.
Well, Your Honour, I mean, again, so the department, as I've already referred to concessions, so we from time to time have concessionaires who breach conditions of concessions, and sometimes the conditions are not expressed in a particularly helpful way. And so we often have to make a call between, do we deal with this, you know, as a concession condition issue, or sometimes it has gone further than that and it has to be dealt with as a prosecution. And we have prosecuted concessionaires where they have undertaken activities which are not within, we consider, the terms of their conditions, and we have lost. So I'm very familiar with the issues that were stepped through by Mr. Cummings, because those are matters that also the department has to address in its own regulatory function. And again, Your Honour, I guess I don't see those issues as being insurmountable in terms of meeting a criminal standard of proof. What I guess I also took some heart from is that actually what the compliance plan attached to Mr. Cummings' evidence indicated is that that is very much the council's final option, and that there are a number of other steps that it will go through before it gets there. And again, as Mr. Moore points out, there is certainly the ability for the third party, the superior permit holder, to apply for an enforcement order or to take a private prosecution. And if they were to do that, then they are going to be subject to that same standard of proof. So that's you know, so again, they will have to be certain of their ground to take that action.
Okay. And so in terms of what the court has proposed, no red flags?
No.
Okay. All right, well, we'll take a break and come back on Thursday, unless people have to travel, so... which might be Mr. Walsh.
You'd flagged you wanted to see us in chambers at the end of the day.
Oh, no, I've actually covered the matter that I wanted to see you in chambers about.
Very good.
Okay. You've addressed it.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Okay, yep. I don't want to... Yeah, I'm just conscious of the fact you've got to travel. Ms. Dixon's got to travel. Oh, no. Are you going to be back Thursday?
I made strange travel bookings, and so I am leaving tonight and back Thursday.
Because you
and
have
I have
to be
my closing on Friday, which somehow between travelling I have to write.
So you've got to be back because you've got cross-examination for Mr. De Perlsmaker.
Yeah, I do, because there's certain statements that Mr.
De Perlsmaker
does make.
Did you want to, so do you want to address this now, or should we go on and hear what anything, whether there's anything in addition that you need to say to...
Well, Your Honour, are you going to hear from other counsel or that are in the room, Ms. Dixon and
Well, it,
it
just
Page.
Depends on whether counsel are travelling and, or do we just roll it over for Thursday?
Oh, I'm happy to roll it over.
You happy? Okay.
Yeah, well, I am back on Thursday. That's... Yep. I'm flying back tomorrow night. Now.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Ms. Dixon, do you want to...
Your Honour, so
you're
I can,
staying, so
I can
no
do it on Thursday,
you?
I'd rather.
Okay, very good. And you're local, so you don't get a choice.
No. We'll just do as we're told.
So. Oh, I've noticed that about you. Okay. So, no, that's fine. So we'll adjourn. And I need to issue a minute, which I will do. Just circulating that stuff about deemed priorities, this time noting that we want a definition for downstream permit holder, not upstream permit holder. I'm sure that was a deliberate mistake. Okay, so on that basis, we're adjourned. All rise.